you. Please be seated.
And who do we have here as visitors today?
This is the class.
This is Wendy Lake, Your Honor, on behalf of the appellate Sarah Burton. This is the Burton family, and is my colleague.
Okay.
I'm always curious when there's people here. You know, usually when we come out, there's nobody here. This is Justice Mark Gibbons, Justice Christina Pickering, and Justice Michael Cherry.
Okay, this is case number 56639, Thayer Burton versus State, and we're ready to proceed. We have Ms. Leek for the appellant, Ms. Jimenez for the respondent.
Good to see both lawyers. Haven't seen you in a long time. Go ahead.
Counsel, justices, may it please the court. My name is Wendy Leek. I represent Thayer Burton, the appellant in this matter. If I could have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Certainly.
Thank you. If it wasn't an Alford plea, I may have considered it, but she didn't man up. This is a case about abuse of discretion. This is a case where a judge took a client's rights and held him more responsible and gave him a harsher sentence, the harshest sentence he could give him under the law, because he didn't man up. Now, twice, when you look at the record, you will see that the judge accepted the negotiation, knowing that it was an Alford plea, before anybody began speaking. Then, throughout the canvas, in regards to count one, the judge said, "You're pleading guilty, not because you did this, but because you've looked at the original charges to avoid being convicted of the original charges, and you want to enter this plea. Is that correct?" And in count two, robbery, again, "You plead guilty to the robbery, not because you did it, but because you've looked at the original indictment. You've decided the state has a substantial likelihood of convicting you on more serious charges, and this is your way to avoid sentencing on the more serious charges and a lot more years." It is plain error. Reliance on prejudicial manners is an abuse of discretion, and that's what this court has said in the Brake opinion. And what's interesting is when you look at the case law and you look at Brown, the judge in Brown actually says to the defendant, "If you're not man enough, I'm offering you the opportunity to be a man, and I'll show you some pity." Brown is in 113 Nevada 275, a 1997 case. And this court said that the exercise of constitutional rights is an abuse of discretion. It's exactly the same. The wording is the same. If you don't man up. Now, that is all that the district court took into consideration was the Alford plea. It's not a long discussion by the judge before he sentences Mr. Burton, a 19-year-old, to consecutive time to life without the possibility of parole. And again, Your Honors, this is not harmless error, but this is plain error. And the case must be reversed and remanded back to a different judge. Do you have any other questions for me?
Well, so I guess the sum and substance of your argument is that the judge could have elected not to accept an Alford plea, but once he did, he can't penalize Mr. Burton for entering an Alford plea and not admitting guilt. And has to handle it. That can't be a factor in the sentencing consideration. What would have happened, though, if Judge Smith had said nothing and not said a word, but had not followed the stipulated sentence of the parties and given the harsher sentence then? Would there be an issue?
No, there probably wouldn't be an issue. But the fact that was his sole reason and his sole consideration. The state laid out facts in their argument as to why they thought that the time should be consecutive, and I laid out why I thought that the argument should be why the sentence should run concurrent. But the judge didn't take those issues into consideration, and it would be speculation to say that he did when it's clear in the record that what he said is specifically, "If it wasn't an Alford plea, I may have considered it, but you didn't man up." Had he just said silent and given him consecutive time, I don't think I would be able to be here and say it was a violation of his rights.
Okay. But the plain error standard is a bit daunting. There was no objection in the trial court which is a bit troubling, given the fact that the state is producing case law that suggests this rule that that's inappropriate is not universally accepted. There's a split of authority out there, but I grant you Nevada law seems to run in your favor. Does that meet the plain error standard, and if so, why?
I do think it meets. I think that this case meets plain error. It's a violation of his substance, of his rights, and it's prejudicial. He got the harshest penalty that there could be. Consecutive time to life without the possibility of parole. The harshest. For pleading pursuant to Alford, which the U.S. Supreme Court has said, absolutely you have a right to do. And in Mitchell, the U.S. Supreme Court, that case says that your right to remain silent affects its sentencing. Now, Mitchell doesn't address whether silence goes towards remorse.
Right, and that's where the cases start to split on you.
Correct.
Is expression of remorse as an appropriate sentencing criterion?
And in my research around the nation regarding where the courts come in, the decisions that I found regarding the question of remorse dealt with on multiple times the cases said, not only did we take into consideration the lack of remorse, but we also took into consideration the nature of the crime, the what happened to the victim. That's actually not here. The sole consideration here was the Alford plea. And so that's how those cases don't apply. And in regards to preserving this for appeal, I filed a timely appeal. The case law that the state cites is regarding what happens during trial and not after what happens after trial. And so, Your Honor, I would say that I did preserve this issue. And even if the court doesn't find that I did, I think that it does rise to the level of plain error.
For the record, lay out what the sentence was, what the Judge Smith did.
The sentence that he received was consecutive time of a 3-8 on the robbery, court's indulgence. He ended up receiving, on page 140 of the case, he said that you're sentenced to count 1, 28 to 72 months, concurrent to count 2, robbery 36 to 96 months. I think I'm obligated to sentence him to consecutive time into case C242842, which that case is the murder that is currently on appeal, and he is was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. And then that's where the judge says, if it wasn't an Alford plea, I may have considered it, but you didn't man up.
So he's got life without. Was there a deadly weapon life without also?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Was there an enhancement of deadly weapon?
Not in regards to case C242.
The murder case.
The murder, I'm not privy to the sentence of that. I'm assuming that there was a weapon involved, but that would all be assumption on my part.
So right now, even without these sentences, he's serving life without the possibility of parole?
Correct.
See, that's where it comes in as to what, you know, is it some type of harmless thing? I mean, the big thing for him is his appeal on the murder case.
And Your Honor, when you look at actually this court's decisions, when you look at Bushnell, which was a 1980 case, which would be 97 Nevada 593, which is a 1981 case, the judge in that case sentenced the two defendants that went to trial with Mr. Bushnell to a lesser sentence because Mr. Bushnell wouldn't express remorse. And this court reversed and remanded and said that it was a violation of his rights, that an imposition of a harsher sentence based on his exercise of constitutional rights is an abuse of discretion. This cannot stand. So similarly, regardless of he was punished for pleading pursuant to Alford. He was punished for not manning up, according to the judge. And when you think about the purpose of an Alford plea, as counsel, we talk to our clients about that.
Well, that's what I'm going to read you something from the plea, and I'm going to read Ms. Jimenez the same thing, and I want you to comment on it. I understand that my decision to plead guilty by way of the Alford decision does not require me to admit guilt, but is based upon my belief that the state would present sufficient evidence at trial the jury would return a verdict of guilty of a greater offense or of more offenses than to which I am pleading guilty to. Now, how could you argue that that's favorable to your client, as Ms. Hemina has to argue it's favorable, those words favorable to the state?
In regards to the fact that he doesn't have to admit guilt.
Are we getting into the area of Santabello where there's maybe a breach of the plea agreement when a judge demands that somebody man up on Alford? I'm going to ask Ms. Hemina the same exact question.
If I'm understanding your question correctly, when you look at the history of Alford, when you actually look at Alford, Alford actually pled to a second-degree murder in order to avoid the death penalty. And then on habeas, he actually sought to withdraw his guilty plea, and the Supreme Court said, there are times where you can plead guilty when the facts are overwhelming and maintain that innocence. And so that's the purpose of the plea. And that's exactly what happened here. And so, I'm not sure if I'm able to answer that your question, Your Honor, but what you look at with an Alford plea is that it's that opportunity to say, look, the evidence is overwhelming, but I'm maintaining my innocence. And that in of itself, when the judge said he would accept that plea, at that point, Mr. Burton should not have been penalized. Then as the canvas continues, he penalizes him more.
Does that give you grounds to say there's a breach of the plea agreement? Not by the district attorney, but by the judge. You know, judges can breach plea agreements too. And then I'm going to have Ms. Jimenez comment, and I'm sure she'll say the opposite of what you say. But
I would say the breach of the plea agreement is basically saying that if you're going to plead pursuant to Alford, it sets the tone. It has a chilling effect. Saying if you're pleading pursuant to Alford, you're going to get the max in this courtroom. Is that breaching it? Sentencing is the discretion of the judge. But if the sole consideration to giving somebody the maximum amount of sentence is based on the plea that the judge is willing to accept, which is constitutional, which is you have that right to remain silent.
But we're dealing with a criminal defendant who's reading the words, the Alford decision does not require me to admit guilt.
Correct.
So in other words, we're looking at someone reading this. You know, we're looking at this from the eyes of the defendant who's going to be doing some hard time, and even more hard time because of the judge saying you didn't man up.
Correct. And that's why the state had the right to argue. And had the judge said nothing at sentencing and just said, I'm sentenced you to consecutive time, I wouldn't be here.
That's the argument Ms. Jimenez should make, is the argument you're making. In other words, it doesn't matter. Because you allowed the state to argue, really, I think he could take that into consideration.
But that's not what the judge can't take the lack of remorse. And that's the problem, is it's the way that he worded it. You didn't man up. If it hadn't been Alford, you didn't man up. That's where the error comes in. That's where you have the violation. If he didn't want to take an Alford plea, then he can say no. The district courts have that discretion to say they won't accept a plea. In fact, there's courts down there right now that won't take Alford pleas.
So what if a criminal defendant got up and said to his family, I'm sorry I put you through this, and said to a victim who maybe was in the court doing victim impact, I'm sorry, then could a judge say you didn't man up?
Well, that's actually the issue that happened in Brown, Your Honor. And this court, the judge demanded that Brown say that. The judge said, you need to man up. I'm going to give you 30 minutes to think about it. Consult with counsel. And 30 minutes later, the judge takes the bench, and what ends up happening? The defendant stands up and says, I know 12 honest people found me guilty, but I'm not guilty. And the judge maxed him. The judge gave him the harshest sentence and said, I'm not going to find pity on you.
But all of the cases, the Nevada cases, Brake, Bushnell, and Brown that I read, and maybe I'm wrong, but they were all after trial, and none of them were premised on a plea, correct?
That is correct. They all predate Mitchell. Well, actually, no, they don't. Mitchell is from... court's indulgence, and they don't predate Mitchell, but
right, Brown was after Mitchell anyway.
But Mitchell says that right attaches at sentencing, that Fifth Amendment right to silence attaches at sentencing. And so when you look at that in context with the Alford plea, he entered it, and it's the abuse of discretion to punish him for it.
You want to save some time for rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Jimenez, if you need more than the 15 minutes, I'll give you a couple extra minutes because I'm going to give appellant a couple extra minutes. So you probably have up to 17 minutes if you'd like.
Thank you, Judge.
If you need it.
I appreciate that.
And if you could start off just by trying to answer my question as to how, having read that, and I say to you as pretend I'm the trial judge, Ms. Jimenez, doesn't this mean that I can't say man up?
No, I don't agree with that assessment, Justice. What I believe is that this did not breach the plea agreement. The terms of the plea agreement are what the state was going to argue to and what the defense could argue to. And in this particular case, there had been a stipulation to the sentence. The robbery was an agreed 3 to 8 years. There was a stipulation that the two counts in this case were to run concurrent. There's actually a third case, a shooting case, an assault with a deadly weapon that he pled with, and there was an agreement that the assault with deadly weapon would run concurrent to the robbery, and that the only argument that was going to be made was whether or not this would run consecutively to the murder, and that was the same agreement in the assault with deadly weapon case. The state had the right to argue that the assault with deadly weapon would run consecutive to the murder, and in fact, that sentence was run consecutive to the murder. So the judge did not violate the plea agreement because that was within his discretion as part of the plea agreement, which wasn't conditional in any event. It wasn't a conditional plea. The judge could have decided not to follow it, but he had indicated to the defendant that he would follow it, and he did so. I think I first disagree with the defense's argument, or excuse me, the appellant's argument that this was the only thing that Judge Smith took into consideration. He didn't say much when he imposed the sentence, but he listened to argument, which included lengthy argument from the state as to why this should run consecutive, including the fact that this robbery occurred after the murder had happened, after he basically botched a robbery and killed a man. He then didn't stop his crime wave, but he continued with the robbery because he wasn't caught on the murder until some time later. And so there was persuasive reasons why the court should sentence consecutive time, and the court said, I just think I'm obligated to sentence him to consecutive time. To me, I read that as he's taken into consideration everything that's been argued, he feels obligated to give him consecutive time, but that he says, if it wasn't an Alford plea, I may have considered it being concurrent time, but you didn't man up. So first of all, he's not saying if you hadn't pled Alford, I would have given you concurrent time. He first of all says, I may have considered it, which also means he may not have considered it. And even if he had considered it, it's no guarantee that he would have given him concurrent time. So I disagree that the judge's comment on the Alford plea means that he would have given him concurrent time had he not pled Alford. But more importantly than that is that the judge didn't comment on the defendant's Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. I think what the appellant is asking you to do is basically take the Alford decision and take this other argument that there's a Fifth Amendment right to remain silent, and they want to turn that into there's a constitutional right to forever maintain your innocence and no court can ever consider you guilty. But that's not what the purpose of an Alford decision is. There is ultimately a finding of guilt even when a defendant pleads Alford. That's the only way our justice system works. You either are found guilty at trial, you either plead guilty, consenting to maybe admitting to what you did, or you plead by Alford where you don't admit what you did, but you consent to be sentenced and for the judge to make a finding of guilt. And that's what happened in this case. The defendant was adjudicated guilty, so there is no requirement of Alford that the court have to ever treat the defendant as though he was innocent. In fact, I would say that would be highly inappropriate because in our justice system, we don't sentence innocent people to prison or to jail or to any kind of sentence. So there's been a finding by the court that the defendant has committed a crime, that he's guilty of committing that crime. And I think that the cases that we've cited to talk about the fact that the lack of remorse or the failure to accept responsibility are certainly appropriate things for the court to consider in sentencing. But if you look just on the facts, Judge Smith didn't consider what the defendant did not say. He considered what he did say. And I would analogize it to, for example, in a trial situation, a prosecutor, of course, during argument cannot comment on the defendant's right not to testify. So the defendant doesn't take the stand. The state certainly can't comment on that. However, if there's a case where the defendant has given a statement to police, that statement has been admitted into evidence, the state can certainly make arguments based on the statement that was admitted, that was a proper thing to have admitted and that the jury heard. They can make argument about that. And I would analogize that to the situation here. Judge Smith didn't say, well, I didn't hear you say that you're not remorseful. He said, you pled by Alford, you didn't man up, which I would say is probably more to do with not accepting responsibility versus remorse, but you can view it either way. And so he relied on something that the defendant did say. So just on the facts in and of itself, I would say that he didn't rely or make comment or draw an adverse inference from the defendant's right not to speak.
How do you distinguish the cases that your opposing colleague relies on, though, the Brown-Bushnell line of cases?
Thank you. I was just going to get to that issue, and I'll start with those cases, although I want to talk about Mitchell as well. Or actually, if I could, maybe I could
go with Mitchell first.
I think here's the distinction in Mitchell, and there's a few distinctions in Mitchell. Mitchell involved not a sentencing decision per se, but really an element of the crime. Obviously, federal courts, they work a little bit differently, and the best analogy I can make to a state court example would be, for example, a trafficking crime. Trafficking can be low-level, mid-level, high-level, and it contains different punishments. And I think the situation in Mitchell would be similar if a defendant and the state had agreed, okay, the defendant's going to plead guilty to trafficking, but there's a dispute as to the amount, and so we're going to leave that up to the court what amount, what level trafficking this is. I know that's not the practice normally, but it could be done, and that's the best analogy. The court would then make a finding about an element of the crime, and that's what happened in Mitchell. The weight was an element of the crime. It wasn't something that was one of the many discretionary things that a court can take into consideration. It wasn't even related to the sentencing guidelines. It was in the statute itself, and it was an element of the crime. And so the court's holding in that discussed the fact that it wasn't fair for the court to take the defendant's silence on that issue. The state had presented evidence, and in fact, the defendant had presented some evidence too, not through his own statement, but through other witnesses who had adopted what they testified to at trial. And they said it was improper for the court to turn on the defendant and say, well, you didn't testify, I'm holding that against you, and I'm going to believe the evidence the state presented. That would be the same as in a trial if the judge or the state commented on the defendant's right to remain silent, because there's a factual determination that's taking place. We're not dealing with the factual determination as to an element of the crime here. And most persuasively, I think, from Mitchell, the reason that it shouldn't be applied to the circumstances that Mitchell specifically said at page 330, whether silence bears upon the determination of a lack of remorse or upon acceptance of responsibility for purposes of the downward adjustment provided in the sentencing guidelines is a separate question. It's not before us, and we express no view on it. So they particularly reserved that issue. They did not overrule the previous federal cases, which say it's absolutely appropriate to discuss, to consider an Alford plea as one factor in the failure to accept responsibility. And they said that's not an issue that we're addressing. So it simply does not apply to these cases. Now, I think moving on to the state cases, I think that some of the problem with the state cases is that there's become somewhat of maybe contradicting opinions from the court. If you look at cases that cite to Mitchell and that were decided after Brown and Brake, and take, for example, this court's decision in DeZul, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but D as in David, Z as in Zebra, UL, V State, and that discusses whether or not it's improper for, in the case of a sexual offense, as you know, the defendant has to go through a psychosexual evaluation, and sometimes the evaluators consider the fact that the defendant won't admit to having committed the crime. They take that into consideration, and they may say he's a higher risk to reoffend. And that's what happened in DeZul v. State. The court looked at that issue and gave what I think is a more detailed analysis than that was presented in Brown or in Brake. And the court ultimately concluded that that was not a violation of the defendant's right to remain silent. And they looked at the penalty-benefit analysis and weighing in that case as far as whether this was a penalty or whether the possibility of probation was a potential benefit that he could receive. And the courts, of course, talk about if it's a penalty, if there's going to be penalized behavior, then that does implicate the Fifth Amendment right. But if it's not penalized behavior, if it's a benefit, it doesn't affect the Fifth Amendment right. And that's ultimately what the Nevada Supreme Court found in DeZul. Now, that's different than what was found in Brown and Brake, because again, they're basically saying if the defendant doesn't admit to having committed the crime and it was an Alford plea, then he's going to potentially not be given probation. And they said, look, that doesn't implicate the Fifth Amendment. And I think that's the analysis and what the court needs to look at here. That's a more recent case. And I think
what's the citation to Zuhl? It's not cited in your answering brief.
Yes, and I apologize. I looked it up when the in the defense's reply brief, they had commented about the timing of the state's cases, and so I looked up some later cases that were cited to by the cases in the brief.
Sure, I just am interested in the case site.
Yes, Judge, it's 118 Nevada 681, and it is a 2002 decision.
Thanks.
And they actually take a look at the federal, some of the, not specifically the federal cases we cited, but that federal line of cases that talk about the fact that it's not inappropriate for a court to take into consideration a defendant's Alford plea when they are talking about that sentencing benefit for admitting the crime that has been committed. And so the court did look at that, and they found that to be persuasive in making their decision. They found that benefit penalty analysis persuasive, and they said that probation is a benefit. They also made the comment, and this is a quote from that case, that defendants face many choices in the course of criminal proceedings, and the pressure to speak in the hope of improving a defendant's chance of being granted probation does not make an interview compelled. And that's the kind of situation that we have here that took place in some of the other cases where the defendant had the opportunity. He could have expressed remorse, or he could have chosen to accept responsibility, but the fact that those choices exist doesn't mean that his Fifth Amendment right was implicated when there was a consequence. And what's interesting is that if you look at the cases that find that it's a penalty versus a benefit, the penalty often talks about other criminal behavior or elements of the crime as took place in Mitchell that affected the Fifth Amendment right. There are few that discuss when it's a discretionary issue as far as the sentence or the penalty that can be imposed, that constitutes a penalty. The court could have, as he did, sentenced him to consecutive time. He could have given him the maximum sentence, and that was all would have been a lawful sentence within the range of punishment. We aren't talking about a different crime. We aren't talking about, as took place in Mitchell, a higher penalty range because of an element of the crime. We're not talking about an element of the crime here. And so I think that case is persuasive, and I think if this court wants to, it can go even further than holding just that on the facts of this case, Judge Smith didn't comment on the defendant's right to remain silent, but in fact that taking those factors into consideration is not inappropriate on DeZuhl, and that at a minimum, Brake, if not Brown, because Brown and Brake are slightly factually different, is an apposite to the case's later decisions, and that it is proper for a court to take into consideration the lack of remorse or a failure to accept responsibility.
Give me some minutes. Let me ask you this. Sure. Assuming we concluded that Judge Smith's comments that you didn't man up or error, tell me why you believe it would be harmless error.
Well, I do believe it would be harmless error, and that's for a few reasons. First of all, I think it's the fact that he didn't commit that he would have given him concurrent time but for those comments. So I don't think that there's a showing of prejudice, because to show prejudice, and it's the defendant's burden to show it, they would have to show that a different result would have occurred. And I don't think based on this record that they can show that, because that's not what his comment said. He didn't say, I definitely would have given you concurrent time, but you pled Alford, so now I'm not going to. That's not what he said. Furthermore, I think based on the fact that certainly the other case that he pled guilty in was run consecutively, it wasn't the same sentence, but it was run consecutively to the life without that he's doing. And for to answer Justice Cherry's prior question, there was a deadly weapon enhancement on the murder case. It was new law, though, so it was the 1 to 20 enhancement. I think Judge Kadish gave him 6 to 20. I can't recall exactly. It wasn't the full 8 to 20. I know that. And also, so the justices know, that case is on appeal. In fact, I'll be arguing that case in front of the Southern panel on Thursday. So that is currently in the
appeal. So if that case were reversed, it would almost moot this entire issue then, because you'd start over on the other one.
Well, no, not necessarily. That assuming this case is affirmed, that sentence would stay in place, and whatever happened on the reversal, whether it was a reversal, you know, I'm hoping that doesn't happen, obviously, but whether it's a reversal of the penalty or reversal of the trial, whether the state ends up with the same sentence or whether the defendant gets a new sentence, wouldn't affect the sentence given here. It would still be the 3 to 8 and the, I think it was 2 to 6 that ran concurrently and then consecutive to whatever sentence ended up being.
And those sentences were all per the plea bargain.
Yes, the 3 to 8 years was. I believe we had the right to argue on the conspiracy to commit robbery, but that's only 1 to 6, so no matter what sentence he gave, and I believe he did give the maximum, it was less than the 3 to 8 that we had stipulated to. So those were run concurrently, and the only issue was the concurrent or consecutive time between the murder case. So I know I got a little distracted, but did I answer the question, Justice,
yes,
that you had? Thank you.
Could you comment on the plain error aspect of this? There was no objection to the remark by Judge Smith. Does that affect your analysis?
Yes, I think that does make it a plain error analysis. I think that plain error doesn't just apply to a trial. I think it applies to any stage of the proceedings, and certainly...
And how does that work in this context?
Because there wasn't any objection to the comment that was made. It wasn't raised until it was brought up on appeal. And I think, you know, part of the reason for the purpose of making timely objections is so a full record can be developed. Judge Smith might have been able to more fully comment on what his rationale was behind the sentencing, what he meant by that statement, and we're now deprived of the opportunity to have a more full record because of the fact that there was no objection at that point.
Also so, avoided the asserted constitutional error if there was one.
Correct. That's correct. I'm sorry, saying that if that had happened, that would have avoided the constitutional error potentially.
If you raised it to him and said, you can't do that, that's unfair. My client has the right to remain silent, and you're trenching on that right.
Sure, he could have addressed it, either corrected himself or said, you know what, you're right, and therefore the sentence is going to be different.
Right.
Yes, that could absolutely have happened. But I think that, and I certainly think if the court is going to take plain error, I don't think that those prongs have been met. But I think really the bottom line here is that this wasn't an infringement on the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. And if I could, I guess I still have a couple minutes.
Go ahead. You got two extra minutes. I'm going to give appellant two extra minutes.
Sure, thank you. If I could just wrap up, I think when you look at the Nevada State Court's later case laws, I think when you look at the federal case law, including some of the cases that are cited in DeZolle, which cite some of the later Supreme Court case law after Mitchell, that talk about this penalty benefit situation, I think that the bottom line is that this was not a penalty situation. The Fifth Amendment right to remain silent was not involved. I think that Nevada's later state case law certainly uphold that principle based on DeZolle and the opinion that the court issued in that case. And I think that there is no constitutional violation. I think remorse and lack of acceptance of responsibility are appropriate. I think that the Alford plea is one factor that may be taken into consideration. And ultimately, when, like I said, even if you come back to just a very narrow issue of the facts in this case, the fact of the matter is, even based on the little record that you have, Judge Smith never commented on the defendant's failure to speak. He never said, well, you didn't express remorse. He commented on statements that the defendant had made. And so I think certainly factually, that also takes it out of the realm of a Fifth Amendment analysis. And if the justices have no other questions, I
any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Simmons.
Thank you.
Ms. Lake, I'm going to give you a total of 3 minutes. You had 1 minute left, and I'm going to give you an extra two.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Your Honor. Much of the argument of the state goes towards speculation. Well, the judge may have considered. The judge heard arguments, but that's speculation. What we have is the record. The record clearly states, if it hadn't been Alford, I would have considered. That is what we know. That is what the record is. And Mitchell is very clear. Now, I acknowledged that Mitchell doesn't discuss the lack of remorse aspect of the downward reductions and so forth. But what Mitchell does say is that sentencing proceedings are part of the criminal case, and the Fifth Amendment by its terms prevents a person from being compelled by any criminal case to be a witness against himself. He pled pursuant to Alford, and he said he was maintaining his innocence in that aspect of, I'm pleading to avoid a harsher penalty. I'm pleading guilty pursuant to Alford. And then that very plea that the judge had a right to say, I'm not going to take, that very plea is what has him now doing consecutive time to a life without the possibility of parole. The harshest penalty he can give. Your Honor, the state talks about the Duval case, I may be mispronouncing it, and that's regarding probation. We're not talking about probation here. Probation was never in the cards for Mr. Burton on this negotiation. It was right to argue whether it was concurrent or consecutive. And then the judge's sole determination, and it is speculation to say he considered anything else, was the Alford decision to plead pursuant to Alford. And if you don't have any more questions, thank you.
Anything further? No. Thank you.
Thank you
both counsel for this interesting arguments and the briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted. We're in recess until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.